Last week, of course, we looked at the interpretation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream given by God to him, as seen in Daniel chapter 2. The interpretation of the dream was that God was revealing to Nebuchadnezzar what was going to take place in the future. Specifically, that there would be a succession of nations, whereof the last one in the dream, the last nation represented in the dream, would host the birth of a world kingdom which would grow and demolish all the kingdoms of men, and that kingdom would last forever. This would be God's kingdom, and one day that kingdom would rule over all the nations. So this dream that Nebuchadnezzar had was about kingdoms, but really it was also about authority and ownership. Kings have authority, but God owns everything and delegates authority to kings. Now, as we look at chapter 3, there are three things I want you to remember from chapter 2. Now, I guess we've already heard the reading, but remember from last week and from chapter 2, three things. One, a head of gold. Just that pictured in your mind. Now remember that in the dream of the statue, the statue was made of metals of diminishing value. Nebuchadnezzar, or Babylon, is the head at the top, and it's gold, a head of gold. And Daniel, interpreting the dream, says to Nebuchadnezzar, "You are that head of gold." So, just put that detail on the back burner. Secondly, picture Nebuchadnezzar prostrate on the floor before Daniel. He's thrown himself on the floor, expressing praise for Daniel and for God. So that's a picture. The king of the Middle East is on the floor before Daniel, a young man. Thirdly, the promotion of the four Hebrews. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Nebuchadnezzar, with a new respect for these young men, appoints them to positions of high authority in the kingdom, even though they are foreign captives, because he has begun to understand that they are kingdom material. And that is what he is doing. He's running and building his version of a kingdom. So there's three things: the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar humbled before Daniel and God, and the promotion of the four Hebrew youths to high positions of authority. So in chapter 2, verse 1, it says that this dream occurred in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Nebuchadnezzar reigned over Babylon about 43 years. He lived to about age 69. When we come to chapter 3, we have no idea where in that 43 years, or the remaining 41 years, that the events of chapter 3 take place. You know, did this take place a year after chapter 2, or was it 5 years later? Was it 15 years later? We have no idea. But I suspect it was quite a spell later, at least a couple of years. Our text just seems to casually start in on this account of Nebuchadnezzar building a gold statue. We're just kind of left imagining how much time has passed. So, Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue. The dream of the statue has certainly caught his imagination and his fascination. So much so that it looks, in chapter 3, like he wishes to replicate its magnificence in some physical way. This in itself is something that must have taken considerable planning and construction time. The scripture says it was golden. Whether it was made of solid gold, for Babylon certainly had the gold to do that, or whether it was gold-plated or gold-painted, who knows, but it was golden. The implication is that it was at least gold-plated. Remember that in the dream, the head of the statue seems to have been made of pure gold. The text says that the height of the statue was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. And he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Now, presumably, this location was some open, flat area that would accommodate very large crowds. As per the size of this, a number of years ago, and I was unable to find it again, but I saw a chart of what different people groups considered a cubit to be. It seems to have been a pretty standard unit, which didn't change more than 2 or 3 inches from nation to nation, or even from time to time, spanning a period of probably 2,000 years that they used the cubit as the standard measurement. For general purposes, if one did not have a cubit stick on you, does anybody here have a cubit stick? A cubit was considered to be roughly the length from the elbow to the tip of your fingers. And that would be roughly about 18 inches. And so the chart I saw, you know, some would be 16 and a half inches to 20 inches, and there'd be those variations. So in general terms, the statue of gold was 90 feet high, which is incredible. It's an amazing height. And 9 feet wide. So it was extremely large and very heavy. The ability to smelt such a thing, if it was smelted, or even plated, would have been quite an achievement. I read that some of the smelters built by the Babylonians were roughly the size of a railway tunnel, closed at one end with an opening on the other, with the capability of reaching 1,000 degrees Celsius or 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit and powered by charcoal. Now, in that area of the world, I suspect, you know, I agree with Ron. Ron and I were talking about this last week, that they probably had access to oil and gas in that area, and tar. Saying that they only used charcoal might actually be a little bit patronizing on our part, for they were quite capable of large-scale manufacturing and purification of metals, and they sat on these other deposits. So I just want to talk about the contrast between chapters 2 and 3. When one is reading, it's quite shocking to read this abrupt change of behavior between Nebuchadnezzar at the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. And that's why I wish that the time frame had been included here. At any rate, in chapter 2, at the end of the chapter, Nebuchadnezzar's on the floor before Daniel, saying that Daniel's God is the God of gods and the Lord of kings and the revealer of secrets, the revealer of mysteries, implying that Nebuchadnezzar himself has had some great revelation about who God actually is and who the traditional gods of Babylon and Assyria are not. Is this the case? Well, apparently not. Or if it was, there seems to have been some important details forgotten by him in the time that has passed between chapters 2 and 3. After all, the replication of the statue in chapter 3 and the attention given to it is different than the description of it in chapter 2 in his dream. Some information seems to have been lost or forgotten, or certainly it is distorted. It's like he had this dream and he had the interpretation of it, and in the building of the statue he decided to make some improvements on it. The differences and the improvements are really spiritual in nature. I was quite surprised to read this. I found what might be an interesting hint as to why there seems to be a disconnect between chapters 2 and 3. Even though, superficially, Nebuchadnezzar seems to be replicating the statue in his vision. So, I was reading in the Ancient History Encyclopedia that Nebuchadnezzar, in his inaugural speech about 2 years before this vision, promised allegiance to his gods. So, listen to this quote. It's quite interesting. It's amazing to me that this survived throughout history, but there's a lot written about that time. It says, upon ascending the throne, this is, again, the Ancient History Encyclopedia, upon ascending to the throne, Nebuchadnezzar spoke to the gods in his inaugural address, saying, O merciful Marduk, may the house that I have built endure forever. May I be satiated with its splendor, attain old age therein, with abundant offspring, and receive therein tribute of the kings of all regions from all mankind. End of quote. And then the encyclopedia goes on and says, it would seem that this patron god, Marduk, heard his prayer in that, under his reign, Babylon became the most powerful city-state in the region. And Nebuchadnezzar II himself, the greatest warrior king and ruler in the known world. So when we come to the beginning of chapter 3, his pagan roots are showing, but so is his great pride. He is the conqueror and ruler of the eastern world there. He is ambitious and intelligent, and he has all power at his fingertips. He is eminently successful, but he seems to have forgotten something of his encounter with the living God in the dream of the statue, and the humbling of it with having to receive its interpretation through a young captive of Judah. He seems to have forgotten his own words about the supremacy of the living God, the God of Israel. Seems to have forgotten his respect and the promotion of the four Hebrew youths, and there's likely other details he's forgotten or ignored. What he has not forgotten is how important he is in his own estimation. In fact, that little detail is just a bit dominant here. The dream of chapter 2 that had so tormented him was about a statue. It was large and dazzling, Scripture says in the NIV, awesome and frightening in appearance. And so it seems that's what he wants to build. He wants to replicate that. Daniel, in the interpretation, said, you, Nebuchadnezzar, are that head of gold. Now here, somehow or other, Nebuchadnezzar is saying to himself, I'm all gold. Worship me. Recognize my superiority and godlike state. So, how does he get there from where he was in chapter 2, on the floor before Daniel, to demanding at gunpoint, so to speak, that all of his kingdom worship this effigy of himself? How does his pride so cloud his mind that he would forget that God has called him to see another kingdom that is superior to his own kingdom? Well, what kind of an ego is that? Worship my image or die. So, remember that the picture being painted for us is actually an egotistical self-image of himself. Maybe he has not heard God say through Daniel, you are the head of gold. Maybe his ego heard something else, like, you are superior to all other kingdoms who follow you. Who knows? But the bad part is that he is an Eastern sovereign. His ego and his thoughts, his feelings, his lack of feelings, his value system, all of it is law. That is what sovereign means. And yet, with all of his bristling authority and power, the much younger Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego defy the king's order to worship the image. And Daniel seems to be absent, probably out on business. So he's not in this story. Verse 3. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then these men were brought before the king. He responded and said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image that I have made?" Very well. And I'm skipping through some verses here. If you do not worship, now if you're ready to fall down and worship the image that I've made, very well. But if you do not, you will immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Now, remember that Nebuchadnezzar knows that no god of any nation has resisted him to date. So to him, it's a fair rhetorical question. Now, at this point in the game, Nebuchadnezzar has gone to a lot of trouble to arrange this event. So, because of the scope of this, it would not surprise me if it had taken a year or two or even three to pull all of this together and execute. It seems that it included a very large group of people that would have been required to have traveled from all parts of his new kingdom. The categories of authority indicate that all representation of authority was to submit in this moment. For Nebuchadnezzar, it was a point of pride, but likely, I'm just conjecturing here, also a matter of being the ultimate host to a celebration. These people would have had to have been fed, and when you marry idolatry to your stomach, well, it helps solidify one's authority. And the idolatry. To hear, and for him to hear that someone has not, they've come, but they've not participated in the event, would be a bit confusing to him, but it would also be very insulting. These men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are respected administrators in the kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar has taken quite a shine to them in the past, but now my best guess is that they are embarrassing him before all the kingdom. This is a public event, and they are there by special invitation. Well, invitation. So that's, you can take that the way you wish to. It seems rude to disappoint your grand host. Now, reading the text, I actually believe that Nebuchadnezzar feels that he is being very gracious to them to explain the requirements placed upon them with a chance to rectify their error. Because, after all, lesser individuals might not have had the second chance but be put immediately to death without audience with the king. I think that's actually the case. But instead of compliance and apology, he is met with flat refusal from these Hebrew captives. His question is interesting. What god is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Now, in his own mind, he is executing the will of the only important gods there are. His gods agree with him, and he agrees with them. And they're part of each other, as indicated in that inaugural speech that I read to you. What god indeed could help them, even if those gods wanted to? Which they wouldn't, of course. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would be foolish not to comply to the king's demand. So, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, verse 16, replied to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O God, or O King. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O King, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered. And I envision that flash where a person's face changes just abruptly. And he answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps, other versions say their turbans, and their other clothes, and were cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. For this reason, because the king's command was urgent, and the furnace had been made extremely hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the sovereign of the Middle East, the sovereign of the world, as far as he is concerned, has been defied and embarrassed. Now he's mad. That smelter I mentioned earlier, I think that's actually the kind of furnace that's mentioned here. It's possible that this furnace is the smelter that the statue came out of. We don't know, but it would fit the twisted plot of the narrative. The furnace is the express reminder of the level of authority and expectation placed upon each person in the kingdom. An already burning furnace on site or close by would make everyone pretty attentive to their timing as to when they were going to throw themselves down on the ground in obeisance to the king. Kings also were known to burn their prisoners. Assyrian kings did it. And even in the book of Jeremiah, it is mentioned that Nebuchadnezzar himself burned 2 false prophets alive. Whether before or after this event, I don't know. So, likely after. So if you're a person of authority in Babylon, attending this event, well, in the words of that old 1970s CBC series with Paul Soles and Austin Willis, if you remember that, this is the law. Okay? So in they go into the furnace, ready to die for their love of God. Verse 24, then Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded and stood up in haste, and he said to his high officials, "Was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of the fire?" They replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the 4th is like the son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace of the blazing fire. He responded and said, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire, the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw, in regard to these men, that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men, nor was the hair of their heads singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of the fire even come upon them. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants to put their trust in him, violating the king's command, and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or tongue that speaks anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb, and their houses reduced to a rubbish heap, inasmuch as there is no other God who is able to deliver in this way. Then the king caused Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to prosper in the province of Babylon. So, Nebuchadnezzar, he's kind of a all-or-nothing kind of guy, isn't he? To clarify something I've already said, this whole thing, whether it happened on one day or something that happened over a period of week, which I think is more likely, or maybe over 2 weeks, it was very, very public. The image, the statue was large enough to be seen a long distance away. And the authority class of people would have been a very great number of people. And he mentions languages and nations here. So it's a diverse group of people that have been conquered. And those set up in authority over those peoples would be required to be there. It appears also that this punishment of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would also have been equally public, and, of course, is intended as a spectacle of horror, a spectacle of terror, an example to all who would happen to defy the king or offend him in any way. Very many, as indicated in the text, actually saw this unfold. And those who were out of sight of it would have heard about it very quickly. So imagine how the word of such a terrifying event would actually ripple throughout the population of Babylon and then beyond that. But Nebuchadnezzar himself is confronted again by the God of heaven. Sometime prior to this, in chapter 2, it was the God of Daniel that Nebuchadnezzar was presented with. Now he sees clearly enough, or so you would think, that he understands that the same God is also the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So impressed is he that his decree of worship as law is directed away from himself and all gods, and away from the statue, to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The penalty instituted is every bit as severe as the one delivered to these three. But it's really an interesting point to me in that the news of it is to be delivered to the entire kingdom of Babylon at the expense of that kingdom. The gospel, as it existed at that time, was communicated to the Middle Eastern world quickly and with some clarity and with penalty. What Israel and Judah had failed to do as God's representatives in the world, Babylon did through a pagan king at the expense of Babylon. I wonder whether or not, just wondering to myself, whether or not the formal announcement of Nebuchadnezzar's new decrees would have traveled as fast as the gossip did. Both gossip and Babylon's front page palace news would have moved pretty quickly, I think. And so the gospel, as it existed, the knowledge of the living God, was spread throughout the entire kingdom. The most charming part of the story for me, of course, is in verse 28 and following. Verse 28 says, Nebuchadnezzar says, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own god." Remember that I said that this whole thing was about authority. And authority is a matter of interest to both God and Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar here seems genuinely appreciative of knowing, or being reminded in this case, that this God of heaven actually exists, and that this God has all power and all authority. This is the real living God, not a traditional man-made God, some extension of men's moralities. And this God that he has come to recognize is in Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar is no longer angry about being defied. That's an interesting detail. No, in fact, he's actually charmed by it. Again, like in chapter 2, I think I see in him a sense of relief. He really likes what he sees here. And he is strangely ready for it, even though he wasn't just shortly before this. And even though his ego is as big as the Middle East. Carrying one's ego about can be such a pesky, tiresome load. The God of heaven has lifted that off of Nebuchadnezzar, at least for the moment. And God has shown himself to be bigger, if that's possible, bigger than Nebuchadnezzar's ego. And more authoritative than Nebuchadnezzar's sovereignty. So Nebuchadnezzar sees that, and he feels strangely relieved indeed. But something else. God has shown to Nebuchadnezzar that these three men in front of him are of far greater quality than himself, of far greater character than himself. And strangely enough, that actually seems okay to him in the moment. They, though they are young men and vulnerable, had already made the decisions to die very horribly rather than to betray the God that they knew. To burn to death is a terrifying prospect, and they easily could have shrunk from that. And who would rightly criticize them if they did? They were young men who could have valued their lives so much in the moment to have compromised just this once, or to have made themselves absent. I think they had discussed this matter amongst themselves. I imagine that they would have been in prayer about it and been in some sweat over it, possibly, and went in certain that they were going to die very horribly, because everybody dies in that situation. But because God was not finished with them yet, and of course God didn't, I don't think God gave them any warning that they would survive this. But because he was not finished with them, the God of heaven refused to let a little thing like a furnace change his plans for Babylon. And because of their faithfulness, Nebuchadnezzar got to see another person in the fire, a fourth figure, who is likely Jesus himself. That's just amazing. The whole story is so amazing. I can't imagine that level of faithfulness on the boys' parts and their resolve, although the history of the church is full of such accounts, even right up to the present day. Also, I can't imagine God going to such trouble to corner a man like Nebuchadnezzar. But how else could a man like that be communicated with? Somebody with that kind of an ego. I'm sure he had no friends. It took this level of confrontation of his pride and his sovereignty to even begin to understand that there was a greater kingdom than his kingdom. And it was a kingdom that he wasn't even a part of, sadly enough. But the God of heaven was inviting him to draw closer and to look very carefully. And this is the charm of the whole story. This is what I love about it. It's beautiful that God would do all of this for Nebuchadnezzar. Now, for me, it doesn't make God any easier to understand. There is nothing about this man that we would have found very likable. He was a conqueror, a murderer, really, who did not value human life except as tools, who enslaved whole nations to bring his kingdom, to build his kingdom, but God still chose him and called him to himself. It is beyond all comprehension to me, but it happened, and it continues to happen today to undeserving people. But here in our study, it stands in history as a time when the gospel of the kingdom reached the entire Middle East and was planted firmly there as a witness to that world. Next week, we'll look at chapter 4.